Dog Works Training Centers, professional dog training in Denver, Colorado, and Anchorage, Alaska, presents Mush You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush You Huskies is part of Twine Group Media and is syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here are your hosts, Robert and Michelle Forto.
Hey, hello, and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from the mushing capital of the world, Willow, Alaska. And sitting on my right is our sometimes co-host of Mushing Radio, Michelle. Michelle, how's it going this evening?
Hey, I am really glad to be sitting with you tonight, and I am glad that the Iditarod is just about over. But I am looking forward to our upcoming shows on Wednesday nights. I understand our first guest is going to be Zoya Denure.
Yes, she's actually going to be on next Wednesday. She has an engagement that she cannot make it this coming Wednesday, so we already have her scheduled for 2 weeks from now, so we're looking forward to that. But before we get too much into Mushing Radio, we got to bring up our co-host of our Iditarod coverage. It's been a pleasure working with him for the last 15 days on Mushing Radio, Alex Stein. Alex is the writer and director of Mush the Movie, and Iditarod about the Iditarod documentary about the Iditarod. Alex, how's it going this evening?
It's going great. I'm here in Southern California, but of course, right now, wishing very much that I was in Nome.
And I understand that the banquet's going on right now, been going on for a couple hours, and they're already giving out some of the awards, and we're going to talk about that on our wrap-up show today. But are the two folks still out on the trail right now? It looks like on the standings that they've checked out of White Mountain.
Yeah, they are about 15 miles outside of safety. So at this point, it is looking like they will probably, if they can keep up this pace, they could be in Nome before midnight. But I think we're definitely looking at the two of them to be in by 1 o'clock at the latest, 1 a.m. Alaska time.
So we've talked about this from time to time on our show about how good it would be for all the mushers to be in before the banquet, but it does not look like Jan Steves and Bob Klupach will be in before the banquet's over, unless it turns out to one of those Academy Award banquet evenings. What do you think?
Yeah, I believe usually the banquet starts at 3 in the afternoon, so usually it's pretty much done by about 9:30, maybe 10 o'clock. There's a lot of hanging around and schmoozing before the food is served, and then the food, which is served buffet style, and they get, I'm not sure what the exact number is, but between 5 and 1,200 people attend this banquet. I'm bad at estimating, so I'm just going to leave it at that range. But it's pretty packed.
That's a lot of folks, considering Nome is a very small town, and when you have this much influx of folks, of course, a lot of these are support staff for the Iditarod, the volunteers, the veterinarians, the checkers, and all that, and of course, all of the mushers and some of their handlers as well. Have you been to this banquet, Alex?
I have, and it's a fantastic event. It's a great opportunity to be around all the mushers, all of the mushers who make it in. Their families are there. A lot of the mushers who scratch late in the race are there as well. Like if a musher scratches in Unalakleet, most of the time they will go up to Nome for the banquet because it's not very far. And just tons and tons of race fans and volunteers, and it's like the prom for dog racing.
It's got to be a cool event. Again, I haven't been up there. My plan to go to Nome will be on the back of a set of runners, so I'm looking forward to doing that next year, possibly on the Serum Run Expedition, and 2 years from now on the Iditarod, if we can get our team together and qualifying and whatnot. I just talked to my kennel partner today about the plans for next year. So here we are winding down the 2012 Iditarod year, Iditarod and mushing year, and at least at our kennel, we're talking about next year already. So mushing is in our veins here, and it flows all year round.
Yeah, And, you know, I think for people who are serious enough about the sport to be planning for an Iditarod run, it's going to be something that you're pretty much doing all the time for a period of several years. It's not just, we've talked about this before, but you can't just wake up in the morning and say, hey, I'm going to go run the Iditarod next week.
That's exactly right. And today is our wrap-up show, and we're going to talk a lot about the things we've mentioned over the last 15 days. This is our 15th episode of our Iditarod coverage here on Mushing Radio, so I'm looking forward to talking about some of those stories. But I'm also interested to talk about what's coming up for a lot of these guys. And I know, at least for a lot of these mushers, as the season winds down, and there's a few spring races out there. I know there's a Kobuk 400 that's coming up in just a couple of weeks, and some of these big-name teams will run that race. But then mushing really starts to wind down, snow starting to melt, at least here in the Mat-Su Valley and Willow. We had probably almost 12, 15 feet of snow this year, so it's melting slowly, but it is melting. But, you know, for a lot of these guys, Alex, a lot of them are preparing to go to work now. You know, they've mushed all season. They've done what they've had to do. Now for the next several months is when a lot of these folks will go out and earn a year's salary in just a few months. I know we've talked about that a little bit. Did you get a sense of what some of these guys do when you interviewed them for your movie?
Yeah, a lot of, you know, people do all sorts of different things. Some people have kind of your more traditional 9-to-5 jobs, office jobs that are flexible enough so that they can take a couple of weeks off to run the Iditarod. And a lot of folks have more seasonal jobs. They will work up on the North Slope of Alaska and make a fairly large amount of money in a short period of time. Or some of them work on fishing boats during the spring and summer period where they can make a fair amount of money rather quickly.
And just like in my case, I'm probably heading back down to Colorado to work for a little while. I know we have one of our dogs that's been in training up here for several months for executive protection. So I'll be heading down to the lower 48 here pretty soon and spending some time down there earning my salary for the year, you know, when I'm off of the runner, so to speak. Michelle, you have a comment?
Mushers, we need to keep in mind, a lot of the mushers have a spouse that works full-time all year round, and that is their number one sponsor. Just like you, Robert, I do work full-time, and I am probably your number one sponsor. And that needs to be mentioned because, like you guys have been saying, we're in the shadows, but being in the shadows means that you guys have that much more support out there for you so that you can make it to Nome.
That's exactly right. And you know, Alex, you and I talked about this the other day when Dallas Seavey came in first place and won the Iditarod, and I told a little story about talking to him before the race as we were standing in line at the restart for some very overpriced hamburgers. And my friend that was standing next to him said, so what are you going to do if you win the Iditarod or after Iditarod's over? And he said, I'm heading down to Dallas to watch my team play football. And I thought that was such a cool story because you always used to hear guys on the Super Bowl, when they'd win, they would always have that commercial saying, I'm going to Disney World. But it looks like our guy, Dallas Seavey's heading down, at least as he says, heading down to catch a football game in Texas.
Yeah, and that's fantastic. He certainly deserves to have really good treatment in Dallas for the Cowboys.
So what is on tap for tonight? I know we want to talk about a few of the awards that are coming out. I know we have a pretty interesting story about Scott Jansen. We've mentioned him several times on the show, and he did a pretty cool thing at the banquet. But what's on tap for us this evening on our wrap-up show?
Well, you know, I think I made a list this afternoon of kind of my favorite or top stories of the Iditarod this year, and then a couple of things that we just for one reason or another haven't had a chance to mention. So I think we're going to go through some of those things. We have a lot of our Twitter buddies have been live tweeting from the banquet So we have a lot of the awards that have been presented so far that we know about, and special thank you to our buddy Catherine and Nate from IdeaBlog who've been very good about tweeting all of what's going on there. So it's not quite as good as being there, and unfortunately there's no live stream of the awards banquet, but it's pretty great that with Twitter and with social media we can still feel in a small way like we're there.
And it's my understanding that the reason there is not a live feed like they have at some of these big events is just the infrastructure and the internet is just too slow to support some of that. I was on the phone the other day with Hugh Neff, and he said, you know what, about every other call gets out, and then I can talk for a minute or two, and then it gets dropped. So a lot of people don't understand that when they're running around buzzing on their iPhones and their Androids in L.A. or Chicago or Dallas or whatever, that service is very sparse, not only in Nome, Alaska, but even up here in the Mat-Su Valley. And I remember that was one of the qualifications for us buying our home here. I said to the realtor, number one, it has to have plumbing, and number two, it has to have fast internet. So that is definitely an issue when you're talking about the internet age and the Iditarod. And I know you have had that dealing as well, right, Alex?
Absolutely. And if you are in Nome, they're broadcasting the banquet on KNOM, but unfortunately KNOM does not offer a live stream of their broadcast feed. So if you're within their broadcast area, which I can't imagine is all that large. I don't know how big a signal they have. You can listen to it live. Otherwise you're stuck.
You know, we are kind of in that post-disaster zone up here as far as those types of services go, especially if you're in a bigger city like, you know, L.A., Denver, San Francisco, Chicago, you know, all of the bigger cities. I don't think a lot of, Alex, your friends or my past clients in Denver could even fathom the fact that one of my criteria wasn't just plumbing but a working toilet indoors and having access to internet. So I don't
right.
think people can even fathom what it is that we're going through. But, you know, there are people up here that choose to live an even more pioneer-like lifestyle than even Robert and I have chosen.
Yeah, and it's not all that unusual for people to have homes or cabins that don't have electricity or that don't have running water. And like you said, it's a lifestyle choice.
And first off, I don't know what you guys are talking about, all this live streaming stuff that is not available for the banquet. At least we have Mushing Radio on, and we're streaming live all over the place. And I'm sure a heck of a lot of fans are listening right now to us, and we got to give kudos to them. And Alex, I got to pat you on the back from 3,000 miles away. We're doing an awesome job here.
I agree. Not to blow our own horn too much, but I would have to agree.
Not at all. So you said you had a list of stories there. Let's first talk about the things that you wanted to mention throughout this broadcast the last couple of weeks that we weren't able to cover. You know, we tried to go into this with particular stories in mind each day, but oftentimes the coverage ebbed and flowed with what went on with the race. We covered the important aspects of whatever was happening on that particular day. So what are one or two things that you wanted to talk about during this coverage that we just didn't have the time to cover?
Okay, well, let's start with something that is a very small thing, but I think could have a big impact. And that's, for the first time this year, I noticed that there were a lot of pictures where the dogs, the Iditarod dogs, were wearing what looked like leggings from the 80s. So the dogs had this fabric, these leggings, going up their legs. Not all dogs, but more than a few. And apparently, this is something that several mushers started doing very recently, and it just gives the dogs a little bit of extra warmth, so that their muscles don't cramp up when it gets very, very cold. And I don't have any insight into that, but are you familiar with people with people starting to use that, Robert?
Yeah, it's a relatively new piece of equipment people are using with their dog teams. I know Ali Zirkel is a big proponent of them, of these leggings or stockings or whatever they're called. One of the primary reasons that folks are using them is the dogs get what they call chicken feet. And what happens is as the dogs run through this deep snow that is hard-crusted, icy-type snow, it's wearing off the hair on the dog's legs, and the dog's feet end up looking like chicken legs or chicken feet. So they use these leggings to cover that fur so it doesn't get worn off and raw as they're busting through this deep, hard-packed, very crusty-type snow. And like you said, they look very much like the leg warmers from the 1980s. They're usually some type of lycra fabric, possibly fleece. And then they're attached to the dogs, up the dog's legs, and then kind of in a garter style around their shoulders, and then typically under the harness or under the dog's coat if it's cold enough. And like I said, they're becoming more and more popular. I'm sure a lot of folks, if you've watched any mushing at all or seen any photos at all, you'll see the dog booties, which is a very common piece of equipment that we use on our dogs during most conditions. And that, of course, is to protect their feet. Because if a dog's feet are bad, then you have a bad sled dog. A bad foot on a sled dog can end that dog's run in a very quick time.
Yeah. And it is a very simple thing to just have this little piece of fabric that you can get a little bit of extra protection for the dog. So I think it's a fantastic, fantastic thing to introduce to the sport.
You know, Alex, I don't think it's just for protection, Alex and Robert, because I was speaking to some of the mushers at the symposium this year for the Willow Dog Mushers Association, and they said that it is a protection thing, especially in that harder, icier snow, but it also is great for the dog that is constantly taking their booties off because of the garter system that it uses where it actually goes up around the dog's shoulder. It's much more difficult for that chewing dog or that dog that likes to throw off his booties. It keeps their booties on.
Like a pair of spandex.
Like a leg warmer, yeah.
Yes. So what other story do we have, Alex?
You know, I don't think that we mentioned this ever, but Wade Mars started the ceremonial start in Anchorage wearing a kilt. And several people were wondering exactly what is Wade Mars doing wearing a kilt. And Waddy McDonald, who has run the Iditarod twice in 2010 and 2011 from Scotland, who is a wonderful, very colorful musher and a big favorite, would always come over and have his handlers and he himself would wear kilts for the ceremonial start. And Waddy was supposed to run this race, but his wife got ill, and so he chose to stay in Scotland with her. And Wade Mars took his place in running the Iditarod and promised Waddy that he would wear a kilt for the ceremonial start. So that is why Wade was wearing a kilt at the start, which a number of people have asked about.
And no joking aside here, but I'm sure everybody knows what exactly they wear under coats, and I'm going to leave, or under quilts, so I'm going to leave that at
yeah.
That. Kilt.
You're so not Irish.
I'm not Irish, and yesterday was St. Patrick's.
It's a kilt.
A kilt, yes, a kilt.
Yeah.
So, and you know what's cool about Waddy McDonald? And I spent some time with him last year before the race and, of course, on Facebook and things as well, is that he is one of the first mushers. I believe he was a rookie at that time. He finished with a team of 16 dogs. That is almost unprecedented to finish a team with 16 very strong dogs. So that tells a lot about dog care. It tells a lot about the dogs he was running and what type of race that that Waddy McDonald was running during that, I believe that was the 2011 Iditarod. But we talked a little bit about kilts and Waddy McDonald and what he was wearing. And last year, as we were approaching the restart there in Willow, I walked up to Waddy and I was checking out what he was doing, and he was putting on his bibs, cold weather gear, and underneath that he had on a pair of Homer Simpson flannel PJs. And I had to say, you know, Waddy, what's going on there? And he goes, what are you talking about? I wear these under my bibs every day. So not only does he wear kilts at the ceremonial start, but he wears Homer Simpson PJs out on the trail.
And I just want to point out that that is the type of detail that you cannot get anywhere else but Mushing Radio.
I want to point out that Robert must have taken him up on his idea, because I catch him wearing his pajama pants under his bibs as well.
They're comfortable.
It sounds like a good practical solution, actually.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, our thoughts definitely go out to Waddy's wife. I know she was having a real rough time there. Do you have any idea on her health now? Any updates on that? I know he's pretty active on Facebook and things.
He hasn't said anything about it lately. So I don't have any other updates other than she seemed to be doing better, but still not well enough for him to come out here and run Iditarod this year.
Any other stories we wanted to mention that we just didn't get the chance?
You know, there was an additional story about Zoya Deneur, who I'm sure she'll talk about this when you have her on as well. But after she had scratched, she was flying back to Anchorage, and she had a bag of her personal items. And of course, she was in the middle of Iditarod, so she hadn't planned to be coming back, and she didn't have a suitcase or anything that you would carry your stuff with. So she had her personal belongings in a big trash bag, and when she got back to Anchorage, it had been either taken or misplaced or mixed up with another bag. So I hadn't heard whether she got her personal belongings back, but they were missing for a while, which had to be incredibly frustrating on top of, you know, having the frustration of having to scratch because your dogs weren't doing well in the middle of Iditarod.
You know, and that's such a sad thing. It was most of her Iditarod gear, including her fancy pink parka and her fancy beaver mitts and bibs and all of that stuff. She said, I think, if I remember correctly, $1,500 to $2,000 worth of gear that was stolen off that flight. And, you know, that just, again, shows the mentality of some folks. I don't understand why somebody would want to do that, but, you know, that happens all the time. Your stuff is not safe anywhere, including the villages of Alaska.
Yeah, and obviously, hopefully that wasn't someone purposely taking her stuff, but just a mix-up, and I'm sure she'll fill you in on that when you talk to her as well.
You know, guys, we've been talking about logistics for the last couple of days, too, and I just wanted to mention when Hugh Neff, we have been having his dogs, and we had his extra sled, and we sent his extra sled to Unicolete, and part of the logistics is just unbelievable. As Robert and I mentioned the other day when we were picking up Hugh's dogs that came in from Nome, but we were speaking with one of his handlers today, and she said that she's not even sure when his sled will be coming back from Nome. It could be as much as 3 weeks. So it's amazing to me how some of these mushers will be going to run the Kobuk 400, and they're going to use some of the gear that they just finished up with in Nome, and it's not even ready to meet the mushers in Anchorage.
Yeah, that has to be a very, very frustrating thing not to be sure where your stuff is or exactly when it's getting to where you need it.
And, you know, I can only imagine losing bags at the airport. I freak out if I'm standing there at the carousel too long and my bag doesn't come in at on a regular trip. So I can imagine if your sled isn't going to make it or your personal gear that you wear out on the sled, and in Zoya's case, if it wasn't taken or just happened to be misplaced. But, man, what a stressful time to lose some of that stuff.
Absolutely. And the one other thing I wanted to mention real quick is we talked a little bit about Dan Seavey as our featured musher yesterday, and I forgot to mention that we did talk about how Dan was running to celebrate the centennial of the Iditarod Trail itself. What I forgot to mention is that when he started the race and also when he finished, he was wearing a special bib. So he wasn't wearing the bib number that he chose at the banquet in Anchorage. He was wearing bib number 100 by special arrangement with the Iditarod Trail Committee to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Iditarod Trail.
Exactly right. And just to talk a little bit about the mushers that were out there on the trail, and we could have show after show about this, but I do want to say that it looks like 52 mushers, because the first musher out, I assume, does not have – no, I apologize. 53 mushers looks like they're going to finish this year's race, the 2012 Iditarod. And we've had 10 scratches. Which is pretty typical in any given year, anywhere between 10 and 15. I'm sure it's been a lot higher in other years. But only 10 guys out of a field of 66 guys and gals scratched in this year's Iditarod. And I know we've talked a lot about it on this show, Alex, about just attempting the Iditarod is very special, and we don't want to take anything away from those guys and gals that scratch. But do you have anything to say about that number, just 10 out of 66 that ended up having to call it quits?
Yeah, that seems to be about a typical amount. We had thought that we might have a lot less this year, because usually in past years there are one or two scratches in the first day or two, and I believe we went 3 days or almost 3 days before the first team scratched, which seemed like an unusually long period of time. So I think everyone who's a fan of this race, when it starts, all we want is for every team and every dog to get to Nome safely. And so perhaps someday every team that enters will get to Nome, but that's never happened yet. And this year it looked like we had about an average number of scratches.
And the first scratch was in Nicolai, and the last scratches was three folks in Unicolit. So we've had them throughout the trail. Luckily, nobody scratched in Yetna Station, which is just 45 miles down the trail. And then, of course, Squetna, which I believe is about 75, and then you have Rainy Pass, Finger Lake, et cetera, on down the line. So Nicolai is a little ways down the trail. Like you said, it's about 3 days, 5 hours into the race. 2 days, 5 hours into the race. 4 days, 5 hours into the race. So that she hung in there a pretty long time before anybody did scratch that first time.
Yeah, and, you know, just to get into some of the other thing, this has been – really, in a lot of ways, a remarkable race. And obviously, the fact that we had the youngest musher ever to win the race is a pretty remarkable feat. But there are a lot of other stories about ways that this race was different and, I think, inspiring in a lot of cases that speak very, very well for the future of the sport. There were three native Alaskans who finished in the top 10. Pete Kaiser, Mike Williams Jr., and John Baker, who, of course, won the race last year. And I don't believe that we have had that many natives finish in the top 10 for quite some time. And John Baker's victory last year, I think, really lit a fire in the native community for native dog runners, that they thought, they really viewed this as an inspiration. And in early years, there were a lot more native mushers who competed in Iditarod, and it had become much less popular among the natives, or perhaps it was that it was just difficult to raise the money to compete. But it's a very, very good sign that we have three finishing so highly, and hopefully, you know, in years to come, we'll have even more native involvement with the race.
And if I could just touch on that for just a second, one of the interesting facts about the Iditarod for pretty much the history of Iditarod, with the exception of Doug Swingley with a four-time championship run, there hasn't been a heck of a lot of success from mushrooms that do not live in Alaska. I know a lot of folks hail from somewhere else and then come up to Alaska for, you know, a couple of years or whatever and train and run for the race. But we don't have any folks that live in the lower 48 in the top 30, I don't believe. Maybe you have a little bit better understanding of that than me, but none of the folks from Colorado or Michigan or actually, I apologize. Ed Stilrestra, I believe is how you pronounce it. He is from Michigan. He came in 25th place. So is he the first one that does not live in the lower, you know, in Alaska, that lives in the lower 48 that's a top 30 musher?
I'm just looking at the list real quick. You know, there's Sigrid Akron, who's from Norway, although she lived in Fairbanks for a while, so I'm not sure where you want to count her. She came in 11th. But it looks like everybody else is from Alaska. I'm
right.
Sure if I'm wrong, one of our Twitter buddies will point that out.
And the only thing I want to say about that, where I was going with that, is it's very tough to come up to Alaska to run the Iditarod if you do live down in the lower 48. I know we have three guys from Colorado, and two of the three ended up scratching. That's a tough haul, not only to come up here just a few weeks or possibly a month before Iditarod, but trying to train down there where they don't have snow all the time, if they don't have good trails and good conditions. It's a tough haul to come up here and try to run a race like this when you're not getting in that quality training like some of these major teams are.
Yeah, and I think that's a major reason why people who are really serious about running Iditarod will move up to Alaska, you know, at least for a couple of years for training and for, you know, just to get used to the different types of snow, the different types of weather, the different trail conditions.
Right. And I know we talked about this on last year's coverage, and we hinted about it just a little bit in regards to this story when you hit that nail on the head about the natives finishing, about the new phenomenon in Iditarod with the leased teams. Do you know of anybody that ran this year that leased a team from someone else? True out leased them, meaning, yeah, were they paid to run the Iditarod for a couple of years and, you know, did that whole thing?
Yeah, I believe there's a fair number of leased teams in the race. Just looking at the top. You know, the top teams are, I believe, all are non-lease teams. But definitely when you go into the second half of the finish, there are quite a few lease teams in there.
And there's always a big difference between leased teams and those rookie teams, those puppy teams, those B teams that we've talked a lot about here. Typically those are the handlers or the spouses or the kennel partners of one of the top teams, like Allie Zirkel and her handler, Ryan Olson, I believe is the person's name. That was her second team. And then, of course, the Seavies. Of course, Dallas and Mitch had very high-caliber racing teams, but Dan was running the puppy team, and of course Matt Failer, who was running the puppy team or B team on Martin's squad, and his
right.
son Roan was running the, you know, the second caliber team of Martin. So we do have a lot of that as well.
Yeah, and you know, not to dive too deeply into this, but I think one of the big disadvantages of leased teams is that you are dealing with a musher who certainly knows the dogs and has been around the dogs, but for usually a period of months rather than a period of years. So if you have someone who has known and trained with the dog since birth or since they were a year or two old, there's a bond and there's a trust between the musher and the dog that goes both ways that you're never going to get if you have a dog that you just don't know very well or a dog that you haven't had a lot of experiences with. And
exactly right.
I think, and sometimes, you know, in the past, mushers have gotten into trouble with lease teams because they've insisted on doing something or they've wanted to do something, and the dogs just refuse, or the dogs intuitively know that what the musher is trying to get them to do is not the right thing or is not going to work. And when you have that battle of wills, it's very difficult, and almost always the dogs will just refuse to do what they know is not the right thing to do.
So, Alex, before we put you on the next story that you want to talk about, I want to put you on the spot one more time in case folks missed one of our previous shows. And
okay.
we do this every year about picking who's going to win 2013 Iditarod. And my picks, as we mentioned a couple of days ago, were Ramey Smith and Ken Anderson. It's kind of a toss-up for me. I think that one of those guys is going to pull it out next year in 2013. We're going to get Michelle's take on this. She wasn't able to participate when we did it before. But who were your picks again?
You know, last time I only had one pick, and that was Allie Zirkle. I think Allie is definitely going to win Iditarod within the next couple of years. And I'll go out on the limb and say that she's going to win next year.
All right. So 7:06 p.m. on our wrap-up show for Mushing Radio on Iditarod coverage. Make sure you send that out in a tweet and Facebook message, Alex, because we want to put it on record here. Alex Stein saying Allie Zirkle is going to win. I'm saying Ken Anderson and or, well, can't be and, but or Ramey Smith is going to claim it on my side. Michelle, who do you think is going to win?
Well, I chose Allie last year. I agree with Alex. I think she's really going to, you know, evaluate what she did on the trail versus what her husband did with the same dog virtually on the Yukon Quest. And, you know, 26 seconds is 26 seconds. So I think that they're going to, you know, really bog down and think about what they did here and there that could make the difference. But I'm also going to choose Ramey Smith. I mean, he's hungry. He's very hungry for this race.
Yeah, and this is a sport where you have to be hungry. If you're not hungry, there's a pretty good chance you're going to be that second or third tier as a musher.
If I were going to waffle, I'd include Ramey as well. But I feel now that I can't back down and that I have to just stick with Allie.
I just got accused of being a Brett Favre?
Uh-oh.
I'm not sure that's what I said.
We might have to invite you in on the Fortos Fantasy Football, Alex.
Well, we're not going to talk about Grandpa Favre. He may come back for another year out of retirement. So we can't bust up on old Grandpa Favre here. So Alex says Allie Zirkle. Michelle says Allie or Ramey, and I'm going with Ken Anderson and Ramey Smith. We would love to hear what our fans are talking about and what they have to say on Twitter and Facebook. Make sure you head over to that Facebook page, hit that like button, because we're going to give out two more copies of Alex's movie, Mush the Movie. So you have to make sure you have liked our page on Dog Works Radio over on Facebook. What's the next story, Alex?
The next thing is something we've talked about before. It's been an exceptionally strong year for female mushers. Obviously, Allie Zirkle coming in second was a tremendous performance. She was leading at a lot of times during the race, and I think even up until the day before she and Dallas came in, and even the run between White Mountain and Nome, there was still some question about whether she'd be able to make up that distance and pull it off. She did end up having the fastest finishing time ever for a female musher. She beat Dee Dee Jandro's 1998 record, where Dee Dee also finished second by more than 3 hours. So a very, very strong finish for Allie. Two women in the top 10, Dee Dee Jandro, who is a perennial Iditarod favorite, and had a very strong race this year, came in 10th. And then we had Sigrid Ekren in 11th. Michelle Phillips was 16th, beating Lance Mackey. And Colleen Roberdia, 21st, also beating Lance Mackey. And then Jody Bailey in 23rd, Anjanette Steer in 26th, Kelly Griffin in 27th. So it was a very, very strong, very, very strong year for female teams.
You know, I'm just wondering if I'm curious, maybe Al or Zoya will go into it when she speaks with Robert, but I'm curious to know if the women on the trail experience the same tribulations that some of the men have been reporting, especially Hugh. Hugh said it was pretty bad out there in places.
Yeah, you know, we've heard from a lot of teams that there were some places where it was just insanely hard. And the Norton Sound crossing across the ice, which usually will take teams 5 or 6 hours, this year it was not at all unusual for teams to be taking 10, 11, 12 hours because there was an enormous headwind, sometimes gusts up to 25 or 30 miles per hour. And it's difficult when you're out there on the ice. It can be a little bit disorienting. I think, ironically, it might be a little bit easier to do it at night because you can see the lights of Koyuk and have a better sense of what direction you're going. But that was a very, very difficult crossing for a lot of teams.
And can you imagine, guys that are listening out there, you're standing on a set of runners about the size of a yardstick, not very wide at all, in 25, 30, 40 mile an hour headwinds in well below zero weather, and it's pretty much just you and the elements. That goes into say what makes mushing mushing. And we've talked a lot about it on this show about the Iditarod being a race of thirds. The first third of the race between, you know, Willow and, you know, the gorge and with the steps and all that. Then you have the second third, which is in between there and the Yukon. And then, of course, the last third after the Yukon from the coast on up to Nome. It truly is three races in itself, and it's definitely a different strategy for each parts of that. And a lot of Iditarod guys will say that. They'll say that they have a different race plan for each one of those thirds.
And also, once the teams got to the Yukon, the temperature dropped pretty drastically. It was relatively warm up until the Yukon. And then once teams hit the Yukon, temperatures just went from, you know, 10 or 20 degrees above zero to 20 below zero almost immediately.
So you are listening to our Iditarod coverage wrap-up show. It's going to be a bittersweet show for all of us here on Mushing Radio. And the reason I'm mentioning this, we only have 2 minutes left on our live feed. Then, of course, we're going to go into record mode. But a lot of folks listened to our show last night after we recorded for about 45 minutes after our live feed was over. And we got into some very interesting discussions about the future of the Iditarod. And I got several comments today, even an email or two from guys and gals weighing in on that. And one of the prevailing comments was, we talked about the Iditarod and starting in Willow. And one of the prevailing comments, at least from my perspective, was if you move to Willow, you have to expect that. And I know that was our understanding as well. Do you want to touch on that just a second, Alex, before we run out of time here and we go into recording mode?
Yeah, that's basically my feeling about it as well. And we talked about the people not wanting to have to move their planes off of Willow Lake. But, you know, my feeling is it's a minor inconvenience for a short amount of time. And when people move into an area like Willow, they should really be aware of what they're getting into.
So let's talk about some of the awards that they've given out at the banquet. And, you know, they've given out some of the awards that they already gave out on the trail, the Spirit of Alaska Award, which was given to Ali Zirkel. It's the fancy spirit mask, and the gold to Jim Lanier, the placer gold, for being the first to – is it first to the Yukon, Alex?
First to Cripple.
First to Cripple.
The halfway point.
And
yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And then we have the first of the Yukon Award, which was given in Ruby. And that's the award we've mentioned before, that it used to be $3,500 in gold and then a 7-course meal cooked by the chefs from the Millennium. And this year the Millennium Hotel pulled out of sponsoring that. So the mushing mortician, Scott Jansen, stepped up and donated $3,000 to Iditarod so that there would be a prize for that. And that that went to Mitch Seavey, I believe. It was given out at the banquet tonight, and Scott Jansen had dollar bills in a specially designed small coffin, because of course he runs several funeral homes in the Anchorage area. And when Stevie got up and accepted it, he said, "I was afraid that you were going to give me a gift certificate."
Yeah, that's true sense of humor there. But you know, when you're a mortician, as Scott Jansen is, I can only imagine the sense of humor that guy has with the job he has.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because we go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to mention, I'm sure a lot of fans out there have watched The Addams Family. And, you know, that was, I believe, one of their professions was a mortician, and he had a very dry sense of humor there. So I can only imagine hanging out with Scott Jansen, not only on the trail, but in training runs. I bet he's a heck of a guy.
Yeah, you know, our Twitter pal Catherine is actually sitting very near him at the banquet. And she just tweeted a couple minutes ago that she told her husband 2 years in a row that it's time to get a dog sled team. And Scott Jansen agreed and said it's the most fun you can have at 4 miles per hour.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So what are some other awards? I know they give out the Sportsmanship Award and the Best Cared Team Award and that sort of thing. Have those awards been given out already?
Yeah, those have all been given out. And they're currently going through the finisher awards, at which point, you know, they're starting with the loss, going up to the winner. People are called on stage, and they can give speeches of whatever length they want, pretty much. But here are the awards that were given out a little bit earlier. Rome Boozer won the Most Improved Musher Award. The Mushers vote on the Mushers Choice Award, which is for Most Inspirational Musher. And that went to Dan Seavey. The Mushers also vote on the Sportsmanship Award, and that went to Lance Mackey this year. In spite of his remarks about Dallas, that caused a little bit of controversy, but Lance got the Sportsmanship Award. There's an award called the Golden Clipboard, which is given to the favorite or the best run checkpoint. And that went to Nalato this
wow.
year. There's the Herbie Nyakpuk Award. I'm not exactly sure what that is, but that's given by Northern Air Cargo, and that went to Michelle Phillips. There's a Golden Stethoscope Award, which is voted by the veterinarians to the most helpful vet on the course. And that was a tie between Ruth Coffey and Tanya Cruz. All the vets, by the way, who work the Iditarod are volunteers, and they come up to Alaska on their own dime. Those who some live in Alaska, but most do not. They come up, and then the Iditarod flies them up and down the trail. Stu Nelson, who's the chief veterinarian, takes very good care of the veterinarians, and they're very well trained and very, very helpful. I almost hate to mention this because I don't want to curse anything by mentioning it, but there were no dog deaths on the trail in 2010, no dog deaths on the trail in 2011, and so far there have been no dog deaths in Iditarod 2012, and you know, we have two teams that are probably going to come in within the next 4 or 5 hours, so I'm hopeful and confident that we'll again have no dog deaths for the third year in a row. And then finally, the Leonard Sepala Humanitarian Award, which is voted by the vets for the musher who has the best dog care and has the team that is the best cared for on the trail, went to Didi Genro, and that is considered one of the top prizes and is a really very coveted prize that all the mushers want to get. And from reports, people at the banquet, Dee Dee was very, very moved by getting that award. And and was very happy to get it. And of course, the Golden Harness Award, which goes to the usually to the lead dog of the winning team, went to Dallas TV's dog Guinness, his lead dog Guinness. Before the main presentations went on, and this has happened at several banquets, both in Nome and in Anchorage, Conway Seavey, Dallas's younger brother, who just won the Junior Iditarod, sang, and Conway has a really great voice. He should be on American Idol. So Conway sang, and then when Dallas got up to accept the Golden Harness Award, he said, you know, as a musher, it's hard to pick who your favorite dog is. It's not like with my dad where he can just say, oh, my favorite son is the one who sings well.
Again, musher, sense of humor. It never changes. We're all very dry. I think we should have our own British comedy show.
Yeah, and, you know, Dallas actually, I've heard him speak at the Finishers Banquet in 2010, and I've heard him speak a couple of times at the opening banquets. Dallas has a really good sense of humor. And I think that as someone who's going to be interviewed a lot and subject to a lot of attention after winning the Iditarod, he's going to be a very, very good spokesman for the sport. He's very, very likable. He's very polite. He is, you know, his love of the dogs and his love of the sport comes through with pretty much everything he does. So, and he's got a good sense of humor. So those are the awards. Those are the awards that have been given out so far. Now they're going one by one through the mushers and having them give their speeches.
And if I could just interject just for a second, one of our nightly listeners, a very big fan of our radio shows, his name is Mike Prescott, sent in by Facebook message his picks for the 2013 Iditarod. And first, it has Ramey Smith. Second, Hugh Neff. Third is Dallas Seavey. So we have the fan picks coming in. So if you're listening to this on your podcast, we would love to hear what you guys have to say in terms of who you think is going to win the 2013 Iditarod. Because we can talk about this all year, folks. We are going to have a weekly mushing show on KVRF 89.5 in Palmer, and it will stream on our podcast on mushingradio.com. So let's keep this conversation alive even after the mushing season is over and the snow has melted, because mushing is a year-round thing, and we do it 24/7, 365, and I'm sure a lot of folks that listen to this do it as well. So also, Alex, what about the Rookie Musher Award? I'm sure it went to Brent Sass, the Eureka Musher. Did he win that one?
Yeah, Brent Sass won the Rookie of the Year Award.
And, you know, we talked about this a little bit on our shows a few days ago. He's not a rookie musher. He's a very well-looked-upon Yukon Quest guy. He's ran several Yukon Quests. And we told a little story about what he was going to do when he finished this year's Yukon Quest. Can you set that up for us about the boots?
Yeah, he was having problems with his boots, and I believe was getting blisters, and they weren't doing all that well, and someone suggested to him, well, you should just burn them when you reach the finish line. And when he was just a little bit outside of the finish in Whitehorse, he took a little bit of the fuel from his cooker, and he lit his boots on fire and came into the finish line with his boots burning. So obviously, like a guy who has a good sense of humor and a little bit of a sense of the outrageous and the adventurousness.
And you find that a lot in Iditarod guys. You often find that a little bit on the outside, so to speak. And if anybody knows a lot about Iditarod, you know about Hugh Neff and the Cat in the Hat and the Gypsy Musher, where he comes out of the chute wearing the Cat in the Hat hat and the little mask, and and Dawson Dolly and all that. This is a very colorful sport. It's not necessarily like it was in the old days, the blue-collar mushers with the torn-up overalls and the old parkas. They're all stained up. It's become much more colorful as the years have gone by. What do you think, as a true fan of this race, Alex, that does for this sport? You know, it's changing from, you know, kind of the old good old boy network where everybody's driving in their old beat-up dog trucks with dogs chained up in the back to very fancy dog trucks like Martin Busser has that's you know, covered in a very nice wrap and all that. What do you think that all this showmanship does or hurts for the sport of the Iditarod?
You know, I think from a fan's perspective, it helps a lot because you don't necessarily have to be familiar with Hugh Neff's record or with his finishing times or anything like that. You know that Hugh Neff is the Cat in the Hat guy. So when you see a guy wearing that big hat with the red and white, you know right away that that's Hugh Neff. Similarly, you know, sort of on the other end of the spectrum competitively, when you see the Siberian team and you see all of the Facebook and internet traffic about the pretty curly tails, you know that that's talking about Karen Ramstad. So I think it's helpful to people to just have these things that they can, you know, they can keep track of their favorite mushers by. You know, Allie Zirkel is always wearing red, so she's always got that particular shade of red for the SP Kennels parka that she wears, and she's always wearing the red hat. So you know that when you see someone coming in like that who's, you know, smiling really broadly and brightly, that's Allie Zirkel. I think those kind of things, you know, those kind of things help the sport.
I agree. And if I could, just to mention one more with Dee Dee and her pink parka that she's become very famous for. But the way I was going with that, not only from a fan perspective, but also from a little kid's perspective, and a heck of a lot of kids all over the country, if not all over the world, follow a lot of these guys in their school studies. And we talked about the Teacher on the Trail program, and a lot of these kids are very attracted to this new fandom of the sport, the Cat in the Hat and the pink musher and you know, all of that fancy stuff that's going on. That's the true fan base, I think, is these little kids that, you know, those are the mushers are of tomorrow. And I know they talked about that several times in the media briefing, that so many mushers have come up after learning about this in the Iditarod, you know, in school. And here they are up here mushing in the Iditarod many years later after graduation.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly don't want to get to the point where every musher has a thing and has a gimmick, but having something that you can more readily identify someone with and that can help you keep track of that particular person or that particular team, I don't see the harm in that. You know, I certainly don't want anyone to be something that they're not, but most mushers have an enormous amount of personality. Some of them are shy and some of them don't like to express it in public, but most mushers have a pretty large personality. And if you can find some way to emphasize that with something small that makes them a little bit easier to identify, I think that's a great thing.
I think that the gimmick, though, is right up the alley for most of these first, second, third, fourth, fifth graders, to be quite honest with you, because for a while there in the mid to late 90s, we were looking at a lot of mushers with a lot of sponsorship commercialism going on. And I'm not going to point out anyone in particular, because all of the big names have had their share of sponsors and major sponsors, including Robert himself had a major sponsor as a mid-distance musher down in the lower 48 that we no longer have. And I'm kind of glad that we don't have those major sponsors anymore, and you are able to see a little bit more of the musher's character, and the kids can say, there goes Zoya and Allie and Dee Dee, and they know them by their colors that they wear, or they know Hugh is the Cat in the Hat, and they relate to that, and that's very cool. It brings back some heroism back to the kids, where they can call a musher of all people, a ragtag, you know, vagabond musher, their hero, and that's nice to see, because, you know, with all of the athletes out there, from baseball to hockey to the NFL to the NBA, and these guys that make millions and millions of dollars, and it's so unattainable for most kids, mushing's not. You know, mushing is attainable if you know that it's not going to happen overnight.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's helpful for people to be able to look at Iditarod and look at the sport of mushing and see something that is not, that does require some work. It does require a lot of hard work, and it even requires some work to follow the race, because it's not like an event that happens in a single afternoon where you don't have to have a lot of background and you can just jump in and then it's over. You know, the Iditarod lasts 9 days for the winner and up to 14 or 15 days for the Red Lantern. So for people to follow that and to have an idea of who the various teams are and what the various parts of the course are is something that takes a little bit more of an investment.
Exactly right. Alex, do you have any other stories or information you want to share? I have one more segment I would like to talk about. We are over on recording right now, so we cannot get any comments back and forth from our listeners. Anything else you want to mention before I go into my last segment here?
Yeah, just a couple of quick things. Certainly one of the major stories this year in Iditarod is Rainey Smith coming from 30th place, I believe, back into Katna, all the way up to finish in third place. And we talked a little bit about him in the past. You know, he's kind of the ultimate blue-collar musher. This is a guy whose dog truck was wrecked. He nearly skipped the race this year because of financial concerns. But this is a guy who, with sheer grit, you know, battled his way back up to finish very, very high in the standings, and, you know, certainly is someone who is going to do very, very well over the next 4 or 5 years.
You know, Alex, I think if he hadn't had to get off of his sled and do the little foot race chasing those puppies this year, I think he would have been a bigger threat than third place.
Very likely. Very likely.
What else, Alex?
You know, this year, we haven't really talked about this at all, but there were spectacular Northern Lights displays during the race this year, and some of the mushers and some of the media covering it posted some things on Facebook, and just absolutely amazing Aurora Borealis displays. The final thing that I wanted to mention is a quote by Mike Williams Jr., who, when he finished, said, "This takes a lot of hard work. You have to keep trying and don't be afraid of failure. You just have to take good care of your dogs, and if you take good care of them, great things will happen to you."
That's an awesome quote, and he's a very inspirational musher. He was doing his thing. I know his cause, if whatnot, was for sobriety. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, there are a lot of mushers who run the race to promote various things. Hugh Neff always is promoting literacy and reading. Mike Williams was promoting sobriety. I believe it was because there have been a lot of problems with alcohol and with alcoholism in rural Alaska and in some of the native communities, and he just wanted to promote a sober lifestyle and be an inspiration for people to be able to achieve things and have fun without alcohol.
Yeah, and like you said, a lot of folks do promote a lot of those causes. I know Dee Dee Genro is big in promoting cancer. She's a cancer survivor, as well as Lance Mackey, and I'm sure several folks that we don't know the stories of. So we have to give commendation for those guys. They're out there promoting whatever their cause is and helping raise money and awareness for that. And speaking of which, if we could go right into our last segment, Alex,
sure.
This coming up this year, you and I are planning on doing something pretty special. We're planning on running the Serum Run Expedition. You're going to be documenting it for a brand new movie. We've talked a lot about Mush, the movie. It's been out for a couple of years and making the circuit now on the film festivals, and you're getting ready to offer it to the public. But in the next year, we're going to be talking about the Serum Run and making a documentary about that. What can you tell us about the Serum Run, and how does it relate to the Iditarod?
Well, you know, the original 1925 Serum Run happened when there was an outbreak of diphtheria in Nome, and they didn't have enough antitoxin in Nome to inoculate and to treat the people who were coming down with diphtheria. And there was, because it was 1925 and it was the middle of the winter, it wasn't really feasible to fly in the antitoxin from Anchorage. So the decision was made to transport it by a relay of dog teams. And so it went up on the Alaska Railroad to just outside of Fairbanks, and then it went, I believe, 675 miles or so on a dog sled relays from dog team to dog team, and got to Nome in a little less than 100 hours, which is pretty astonishing. And because of that, there were, I believe, literally probably thousands, if not tens of thousands, of lives saved in Nome. And it became a big media event in 1925. People were from all over the world were following it in newspapers, and several of the lead dogs in various teams became famous. Togo and Balto, in particular, Leonard Cepala, who ran almost 100 miles during this relay, is one of the most revered names in mushing, and in part, the Iditarod celebrates that life-saving journey in 1925. It also, in part, celebrates the basic importance of dog mushing and going by dog, traveling by dog team to the state of Alaska. But then, and I'm not sure exactly when this started, but there is something that we're going to be doing, which is, I believe the correct name is the Norman Vaughn 1925 Serum Run Expedition, or something.
Yes.
Along those lines. Yeah. And Norman Vaughn is a just wonderful and tremendously inspirational figure. He, among other things, he was part of the first Admiral Byrd's expedition to the South Pole. He ran the Iditarod multiple times, including, I think, the last time he ran, he was 85 years old. His motto in life was dream big and dare to fail. And I believe he started the Serum Run Expedition. Is that correct?
Yes, and if I could just give a little bit of history about the Serum Run and
sure.
how it ties into the Iditarod. It is ran every other year, so it will be ran in February 2013, and it's about a 19 to 21-day expedition. And we start in Nenana, as Alex said, just shy of Fairbanks, about 50 miles south of Fairbanks. And the way it works is early in the morning at 10 a.m., the train comes in from I would assume the Anchorage train comes into Nenana, and they hand over the ceremonial serum to the Serum Run Expeditioners. And it's usually approximately 15 mushers and 15 to 20 snow machine support. And what happens is every day these mushers carry the ceremonial serum on the original route of the serum run. And we go from checkpoint to checkpoint to roadhouse, and each checkpoint or each village that we stop in each night, we talk to the villagers about a particular topic. Last year, I was part of it just as a support person for the kennel that I am partnered up with. And last year, they had on one of the troopers, Alaska State Troopers, was along, and he was the main guy for the educational talks. And they talked about suicide prevention in all the villages and educated the folks in the villages about that. And each year, they do that. I don't know what it will be 2013, but they will talk to each one of these villages as we go down the trail. And this trail follows pretty much the northern route of the Iditarod on down the trail from about, is it Galena or so, Alex? I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, I believe it's Galena.
So from Galena to Nome, it's the same exact checkpoints as it is on Iditarod. So we will come in to Nome at about the same time that the 2013 Iditarod's finishing up. Last year, I think they beat John Baker to Nome only by about 6 hours or so. And what's interesting to note about that is they left on February 19th last year, and they finished their quest, their expedition, just 6 hours shy of John Baker's record-setting Iditarod win, and he did it in about 9 days. So they were on the trail for about 10 days longer than the Iditarod guys. So to wrap this all up, Alex is going to follow us along on a snow machine and film this expedition as we're going about and talk about the history of the Serum Run and interview a whole bunch of folks and try to get some historical figures involved, some of the original Serum Run families that may have ancestors that are still around. I know we haven't got into this a lot, Alex, but what are some of the plans for our Serum Run film?
I don't want to reveal too much about it, but I think it's pretty much what you've said. We're going to be looking at the people who are on the Serum Run. We're going to be doing a lot of the historical stuff, and we're going to be doing a lot of stuff in the actual villages with a lot of the people. And in addition to the documentary, there's going to be a huge educational outreach component to this, and a lot of other things. And it's a very exciting project, and I kind of can't wait to get out on the trail.
And just a little teaser on my part, I'm working on something very cool on lead dog's eye perspective in terms of what they're looking at on the trail for one of the cameras. I know you and I talked about that briefly. And if we can get that worked out, I don't think anybody's done that before.
No, and this is, you know, one of the differences between this and the Iditarod is that the Iditarod is definitely a race. It's a competition. This is more of an educational expedition, and so it goes a little bit slower. It's not the case where, you know, one person is in the lead and that's the person who wins. The real winner for this is everyone who takes part in it and everyone who's in all of the villages that are visited.
Exactly. So, you know, it ties into the Iditarod very closely in that the Iditarod commemorates a lot of the same stuff that the Serum Run does, and that's why I wanted to talk a little bit about that tonight, but also to tell all of our fans, and we got a great letter that you have to check out on our Facebook page. Alex, one of our fans, wrote a very nice letter, and you have to make sure you check that out and give her a response, but it's also to tell that, unfortunately, we will not be doing our mushing radio coverage of the 2013 Iditarod because you and I should be, if everything works out as we have planned and it appears to be falling into place, you and I will be out there on that same trail that a lot of these guys will be out on.
Yes, and in fact, we'll be making the trail safe for them, is how I like to think of it.
There you go. Michelle, you have a comment?
Yes, I would like to say that if we have this many listeners this year that count on what we bring, to the show, by all means, I will be here and I can do the show. I just need some teaching lessons and you to find me an appropriate co-host.
So there you go. We've made our predictions. We've talked about who's going to win the 2013. Now we just need somebody that can co-host the 2013 coverage of the Iditarod. So all of you guys that are just dying to be on Mushing Radio, who think you have what it takes to be the next Mushing Radio host, send over a tweet, a Facebook message, or whatever, and we can line you up to get on the next coverage. Because Alex and I, we didn't start talking about this until mid-February, so it is never too late to become the next host of Iditarod 2013 coverage on Mushing Radio. What do you think about that, Alex?
I think that sounds like a fantastic plan. And I'd also like to point out that just in case my prediction is wrong, I will not be reachable. I'll be out on the trail somewhere where I will not be responsible for my prediction that I made.
Me too.
I'll hold you both to it.
So there you have it, guys. This is our wrap-up show, 2012 coverage, 15 days in the making. What an awesome thing that we were a part of. We're so thankful to all of our fans. Tremendous support from our fans. We've had all kinds of listeners, all kinds of feedback back and forth. Alex, any parting words here?
I want to thank you and Michelle and, of course, Radio Free Palmer. It's been a tremendous thing to be part of. And again, want to encourage people to drop by our Facebook page, drop us a message, tell us what your thoughts are, tell us what sort of things that you'd want to see next year, or just make your predictions for who's going to win. Follow me on Twitter at Coldfoot Films and Robert at Robert Forto. And it's been a fantastic race, and I've really enjoyed being a very small part of it. From here.
I'm going to save my congratulations for last, but Michelle, what do you have to say as our sometimes host on Mushing Radio?
Well, you know, sometimes my mind gets away with me. I might be in for it next year, but I'm looking forward to hosting the show all by myself. I've enjoyed our time together, even through all of the technical difficulties Alex and I had to undergo, but I'm just glad that everybody out there, said the kind words, called us professionals. You know, that just blows my mind.
You know, we started this show 3 years ago in Denver, Colorado, as Dog Works Radio. At the time, it was Dog Doctor Radio, and we started as a really small podcast. And we just had a few listeners and, you know, some just really, really small shows. And over the last 3 years, we've had, I don't know, 200, 250 shows under our belt, under all of our radio shows, Mush You Huskies, now Mushing Radio, Dog Works Radio. We've had some great guests on throughout the years, and Alex has been on our show, and that's how he and I met, was on Facebook, and then he was a guest on my show for his movie. So social media has really brought us together on this platform, and it's been awesome. We've done some great things here this year on Mushing Radio. We've had a great partner with Radio Free Palmer to be able to use their studio during this time, and the president or the top dog, if you will, of Radio Free Palmer was in the studio on day 10 of our coverage, which was the day that Dallas CV won the Iditarod, and we did our normal half-hour show there at 6:30, and we were wrapping up, and we were ready to pack it up for the evening, and he walked into the studio and he said, you know what would be great? If we covered this live on the radio, and we interrupted their programming to talk about Dallas TV coming in for the 2012 Iditarod, and Alex was giving us some great commentary about what was happening and the video feeds and, you know, just everything being tied together by social media and Facebook and Twitter, and here we are on Mushing Radio, which is a social media type platform. We've done some awesome things, and we got to make sure that we give out a ton of thanks to all of our fans. I think we've had some remarkable listenership numbers well into the 100,000 folks that listened to us over the last couple of weeks. We've had so many comments back and forth on Facebook where they said that you guys are our nightly entertainment. We are the guys that they're listening to at their dinner hour. And that is so cool. You know, everybody thinks that radio is a forgotten medium. It's not. This is where true talk happens. You know, we can sit around and veg out on TV and watch sports and, you know, type away on our computers. But this is how a lot of our country got started, by sitting around the radio with the family and listening to these shows. And this is how our country was built in the 20s and in the 30s and things. So even in 2012, we're covering a race that is not only historical, a 40-year race on a 100-year trail, we're still talking about it on the radio, and I think that's totally awesome. And I got to give a heads up and a handout and a big pat on the back to my co-hosts here, Alex in California, and my wife, Michelle, here in the mushing capital of the world, Willow, Alaska. So with that, I'm going to close. Alex, anything else before we hang it up?
You know, just one more thing. A lot of people have asked me over the past few years, what is it that attracts you to Iditarod, and what is it about dog mushing that is so special? And I thought a lot about that over the past couple of years, and I think ultimately what it comes down to is that the Iditarod and long races like this and things like the Serum Run expedition are so much larger than life, and so inspirational on a very deep and primal level. And it seems a lot of times in our day-to-day lives that the world gets smaller and smaller, and it's hard to find something that really just grabs you and inspires you. And these races and these dog teams and these people who choose to devote months and years of their life to pursuing this dream is just phenomenal to me. And every day I talk to or read about or hear about or see someone interviewed, it's a constant source of inspiration to me. And I am so happy to be able to share that with other people. And, you know, I think that's really what ultimately this is about, is finding whatever your dream is, whether it involves dog racing or you know, anything else, finding what your dream is and working towards it and finding a way to make it a reality.
Well said, Alex. So with that, we're going to close our 2012 Iditarod coverage here on Mushing Radio. Make sure you check us out next Wednesday, KVRF 89.5 in Palmer, Alaska, streaming live at that time, radiofreepalmer.org, and on a podcast at any time on mushingradio.com. On behalf of my co-host, Michelle Forto, sitting beside me here in Willow, and my good friend Alex Stein in California, this is Robert Forto. Never forget your dreams. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.